The Shallows isn't just another technology critique. It's the book that fundamentally changed how we understand our relationship with digital media. When Nicholas Carr first published his provocative Atlantic article, "Is Google Making Us Stupid?" in 2018, it triggered a global conversation about technology's cognitive effects that continues today. The book that followed became a Pulitzer Prize finalist and a New York Times bestseller, with Bill Gates naming it one of his 5 favorite books of 2020, despite its challenging perspective on the technologies Gates helped pioneer. Even Steve Jobs, while creating the iPad, famously limited his own children's screen time, perhaps influenced by the research Carr synthesizes. The Shallows arrived at a pivotal moment when smartphones were becoming ubiquitous, but before we fully grasped their neurological impact, offering a prescient warning that has only grown more relevant with time. Something was happening to Nicholas Carr's brain, and he didn't like it. Once able to immerse himself in books for hours, plunging into the depths of complex arguments and literary narratives, he found himself increasingly skimming the surface, like a guy on a jet ski, rather than a deep-sea diver. The culprit? The internet. While it had become invaluable for his writing and research, it had also reshaped his thinking to expect information in a swiftly moving stream of particles. What's most striking is how common this experience has become. Scott Karp, once a voracious reader, stopped reading books entirely, wondering if his thinking itself had changed. Pathologist Bruce Friedman described his thinking as taking on a staccato quality, confessing, "I can't read War and Peace anymore." Philip Davis, a doctoral student, admitted to skimming with very little patience for long, drawn-out, nuanced arguments. For younger generations, traditional book reading increasingly seems outdated. Rhodes scholar Joe O'Shea proudly declares, "I don't read books," preferring to extract relevant information quickly through search engines. Research on Generation Net reveals they don't read linearly, but skip around, scanning for pertinent details. Even English professors lament their inability to get students to read entire books. What's happening here isn't merely a shift in habits, but a profound transition between two modes of thinking, trading the calm, focused, undistracted linear mind for one that processes information in short, disjointed, often overlapping bursts. This shift feels intoxicating, but may have profound consequences for how we think, learn, and create. Think about your own reading habits. How often do you find yourself checking your phone while reading? How many browser tabs do you typically have open? The scattered attention we've normalized would have seemed bizarre just 20 years ago, yet we've adapted to it with remarkable speed, perhaps too much speed for our own cognitive good. For most of the 20th century, scientists believed the adult brain's structure was fixed and unchangeable after childhood, something like a concrete structure that could only decay with age. This view created what psychiatrist Norman Doidge called neurological nihilism, offering little hope for those with brain injuries or mental illnesses. Everything changed in 1968 when neuroscientist Michael Mrsenich made a groundbreaking discovery while mapping monkey brains. After severing sensory nerves in the monkey's hands, he observed that when the nerves regenerated haphazardly, the brain initially became confused. But months later, the brain had reorganized itself, creating new neural maps corresponding to the new nerve arrangements. Though initially dismissed, Mrsenich's research eventually triggered a wholesale reevaluation of brain function, revealing that virtually all neural circuits, whether involved in feeling, seeing, hearing, thinking, or remembering, are subject to change throughout life. The secret to this neuroplasticity lies in our synapses, where chemical reactions register experiences in neuropathways. When we perform tasks, neurons join through neurotransmitters like glutamate. Repeated experiences strengthen these links through both physiological changes, increased neurotransmitter release, and anatomical ones, new neuron generation. Scientists summarize this with Hebb's rule: cells that fire together wire together. This plasticity enables remarkable healing. When someone goes blind, their visual cortex doesn't remain dormant, but quickly repurposes for audio processing or braille reading. Similarly, those who lose limbs experience neural reorganization as brain areas once dedicated to the missing limb begin processing sensations from other body parts. These discoveries have led to breakthrough therapies like Edward Taub's program that helped stroke victims regain movement through intensive repetitive exercises that formed new neural circuits. Our tools physically reshape our brains. When Taub studied right-handed violinists, he found significantly enlarged brain areas processing signals from their left hands compared to non-musicians. Even more remarkably, monkeys trained to use rakes and pliers showed neural growth in visual and motor areas controlling their hands, with their brains eventually incorporating the tools into their body maps, treating pliers as if they were fingers. But neuroplasticity offers both liberation and limitation. While it frees us from genetic determinism, allowing intellectual flexibility throughout life, this adaptability comes with a paradox. The same mechanisms enabling learning can lock us into rigid behaviors. As circuits strengthen through repetition, activities become habits. Neglected mental skills don't just fade. Their brain map space gets reallocated to skills we practice instead, what Jeffrey Schwartz calls survival of the busiest. Though we can rebuild lost skills with effort, our neural pathways become paths of least resistance that grow increasingly difficult to redirect. Marshall McLuhan's famous phrase, "the medium is the message," wasn't just celebrating new communication technologies, but warning of their transformative power. McLuhan understood that we fixate on content while remaining blind to how the medium itself reshapes our thinking. He scoffed at media mogul David Sarnoff's claim that technology is neutral and only its use determines value, calling this the numb stance of the technological idiot. For McLuhan, the content of media is merely the juicy piece of meat carried by the burglar to distract the watchdog of the mind. Our intellectual development mirrors the evolution of map-making, from primitive scribbles to sophisticated abstractions. Maps didn't merely record this intellectual evolution, but propelled it, embodying and disseminating new ways of seeing and thinking. By creating reduced substitute spaces for reality, maps enabled discoveries of structures otherwise invisible, giving humans more comprehending minds. Similarly, mechanical clocks transformed our experience of time from a continuous cyclical flow to precisely measured segments. Beginning with Christian monks needing punctual prayer schedules, timekeeping technology spread to royal courts and eventually restructured society. As people moved from countryside to towns, their days increasingly governed by bells marking ever finer divisions of time. As clocks became smaller and more personal, they transformed from public regulators to intimate companions that constantly reminded us of time used, time spent, time wasted, spurring Western individualism. Like maps, clocks fundamentally changed our thinking, training our minds to divide and measure, to see components within wholes. Technologies like maps and clocks embody an intellectual ethic, assumptions about how the mind works that often goes unrecognized by their inventors and users, but profoundly shapes our thinking. While we may consciously choose which tools to use, the broader historical view suggests technologies follow their own logic, often reshaping human activity in unanticipated ways. Technologies reshape our metaphors, too. Once maps became common, people began to map all kinds of relationships. After clocks spread, we saw everything, even nature, as operating like clockwork. God became the great clockmaker and creation a puzzle rather than a mystery. As Descartes noted in 1646, "Doubtless when the swallows come in spring, they operate like clocks." Technologies that restructure language exert the strongest influence over our intellectual lives. While language itself is innate, reading and writing are unnatural acts, requiring deliberate brain shaping. Neurological studies show literate brains differ from illiterate ones in visual processing, reasoning, and memory formation. Writing began with simple clay tokens around 8000 BC, requiring new neural pathways connecting visual cortex to sense-making brain regions. By 4000 BC, Sumerian cuneiform and Egyptian hieroglyphs emerged with complex characters that demanded extensive crisscrossed neural circuits linking sight, hearing, spatial analysis, and decision-making. These systems were so mentally taxing, they remained elite technologies. The Greek alphabet revolutionized writing by representing all speech sounds with just 24 characters, requiring fewer perceptual and memory resources and activating less brain area than pictorial symbols. In purely oral cultures, knowledge was limited to what could be memorized. Language evolved to aid memory storage and transmission, becoming rhythmical and formulaic. While McLuhan believed pre-literate peoples enjoyed a more intense, sensuous involvement with the world than literate societies, writing liberated knowledge from individual memory constraints. Literacy, as Arng argued, is absolutely necessary for the development of science, history, philosophy, and explicative understanding of literature and art. In the ancient world, reading was primarily done aloud. St. Augustine was baffled upon discovering Bishop Ambrose reading silently, wondering if he was merely trying to rest his voice. Early writing lacked word separation, scriptura continua, and standardized word order, reflecting language's origins in speech. This placed an extra cognitive burden on readers, who had to slowly parse text as they read, making reading a laborious puzzle-solving exercise rather than a fluid experience. As literacy expanded in the Middle Ages, practical needs drove a revolutionary change in writing. By the 13th century, writers had begun imposing rules of word order and separating words with spaces. This transformation sparked profound cognitive changes, allowing readers to process text more efficiently. The brain developed specialized regions for rapid text decoding, freeing mental resources for deeper interpretation. Silent reading of books demanded sustained concentration, a mental discipline that doesn't come naturally to humans. Our brains have primitive bottom-up mechanisms that constantly shift attention to environmental changes, an evolutionary advantage for survival. Reading required readers to counter their instinctive distractedness by applying greater top-down control over attention. In the quiet spaces created by undistracted reading, people formed their own associations and ideas. They thought deeply as they read deeply. Around 1445, Johannes Gutenberg combined three crucial inventions: movable metal type, a refined wooden screw press, and oil-based ink to create the letterpress. Though his magnificent Bible project bankrupted him, his invention rapidly transformed the world. The presses produced not just contemporary masterpieces, but also affordable classics, giving intellectual depth to the emerging book culture. Books allowed readers to compare their thoughts with others, creating what became known as the Republic of Letters, open to anyone who could read and write. The literary mind, once confined to monasteries and universities, had become the general mind. Deep reading creates a profound merger between reader and text, where the reader became the book. Recent neuroscience confirms this poetic insight. Brain scans reveal that during deep reading, our minds mentally simulate each new situation in a text, activating the same neural regions involved when we perform similar real-world activities. The bond between writer and reader has always been symbiotic, with writers pushing language into new territories and readers following these complex paths. This relationship expanded English vocabulary from a few thousand words to nearly a million as writers competed for increasingly sophisticated readers. The mental discipline required to follow extended written arguments enriched human consciousness itself. Like our medieval ancestors, we find ourselves caught between technological epochs. After 550 years of dominance, the printing press is being pushed from the center of intellectual life to its edges. Now, with computers and the internet becoming our primary means of storing and sharing information, a new intellectual ethic is taking hold, and our neural pathways are once again being rerouted. Alan Turing's concept of a universal machine demonstrated that a single digital computer could be programmed to perform any information processing task. What Turing couldn't anticipate was how his universal machine would become our universal medium, with the internet subsuming virtually all other intellectual technologies by translating everything into digital code. As computing speed increased exponentially and costs plummeted, processing costs dropping 99.9% since the 1960s, the web rapidly replayed the entire history of modern media, first replicating Gutenberg's press with simple text, then incorporating increasingly sophisticated images, animations, audio, and finally high-definition video. Unlike previous mass media, the net is bidirectional, allowing users not just to consume, but to create and distribute content while connecting with businesses and each other through social networks. Our engagement with the internet has grown dramatically, with North American adults spending an average of 12 hours online weekly by 2009, double the 2005 figure. Young adults spend even more time online, 19 hours weekly, while children between 2 and 11 use the net about 11 hours weekly. Text messaging has exploded as one of computing's most common applications, with the average American sending or receiving nearly 400 texts monthly by 2009, while teenagers average an astonishing 2,200 texts monthly. Contrary to assumptions, internet use hasn't replaced television viewing. Studies show TV watching has actually increased during the internet era, reaching 153 hours monthly for Americans in 2009, the highest level since Nielsen began tracking in the 1950s. What has declined is time spent with print media. By 2008, Americans over 14 read printed works just 143 minutes weekly, down 11% from 2004. With young adults reading only 49 minutes weekly, a 29% drop. The internet has dissolved the boundaries between previously fragmented media forms. Before the net, media history was characterized by specialization: books for text, TV for moving images, radio for sound, calculators for computation. Digital technology has replaced these special-purpose tools with an all-purpose tool, following capitalism's economic logic as digital production and distribution costs are dramatically lower. Reading online fundamentally differs from reading print. Research shows reading is both visual and tactile, with the physical experience of holding printed material affecting cognitive processing. Hyperlinks, while similar to footnotes, actively propel us toward other texts rather than merely referencing them. Searchability fragments works, drawing attention to snippets rather than holes. The multimedia nature of the web creates an ecosystem of interruption technologies that constantly divides our attention. The shift in our reading and research approach is a direct consequence of our reliance on the internet, and it reflects a deeper change in our thinking. While search engines have enabled research efficiencies, our brains engage less directly and more shallowly when using strategies focused on efficiency and, once over, lightly, information processing. In a 2003 study, library scientist Ziming Liu found that 85% of well-educated professionals reported spending more time reading electronic documents, with 81% reporting increased browsing and scanning, and 82% doing more non-linear reading. Only 27% said their in-depth reading was increasing, while 45% said it was declining. A screen-based reading behavior, characterized by browsing, scanning, keyword spotting, one-time reading, and non-linear reading, is emerging, while time spent on in-depth reading and concentrated reading steadily falls. While skimming has always been important, what's troubling is that it's becoming our dominant reading mode. Once a means to identify information for deeper study, scanning is now becoming an end in itself. we're witnessing a reversal of the early trajectory of civilization, evolving from cultivators of personal knowledge to hunters and gatherers in the electronic data forest. There are compensations. Research shows certain cognitive skills are strengthened by computer use, particularly lower-level functions like hand-eye coordination, reflex response, and visual processing. Web searching likely strengthens pattern recognition and fast-paced problem-solving. However, these benefits come at a cost. Jordan Grafman of the National Institute of Neurological Disorders explains that while multitasking may make our brains more nimble, it hampers our ability to think deeply and creatively. The more we multitask, the less deliberative you become, the less able to think and reason out a problem, making us more likely to rely on conventional ideas rather than original thinking. Given our brain's plasticity, neural circuits devoted to scanning, skimming, and multitasking are strengthening, while those used for deep reading and sustained concentration are weakening. Stanford researchers found heavy media multitaskers were much more easily distracted by irrelevant environmental stimuli, had less control over working memory, and struggled to maintain concentration. They exhibited a greater tendency for bottom-up attentional control, becoming suckers for irrelevancy. The mental functions losing the survival of the busiest brain cell battle are those supporting calm, linear thought functions we use for lengthy narratives or involved arguments. The winners are functions that help us quickly locate, categorize, and assess disparate information bits, while maintaining mental bearings amid stimuli bombardment, functions similar to those performed by computers. Socrates correctly predicted that writing would diminish reliance on internal memory as people began storing thoughts externally. Yet books had an unexpected effect. While providing external storage, they also enriched memory by offering diverse knowledge that deep reading encouraged people to internalize. Reading transformed memory from a socially determined construct to the foundation of individual perspective. People became authors of their own memories, as Shakespeare suggests when Hamlet calls memory the book and volume of my brain. Memory consolidation depends on attentiveness. Storing explicit memories and forming connections between them requires strong mental concentration, enhanced by repetition or emotional engagement. As Nobel Prize-winning neuroscientist Eric Kandel explains, information must be thoroughly and deeply processed by connecting it with existing knowledge. Kandel's pioneering research on sea slugs revealed the profound physiological differences between short-term and long-term memory. His team discovered that memory formation involves not just biochemical changes, but anatomical ones. Neurons actually grow entirely new synaptic terminals when forming long-term memories. In experiments, they observed that a sensory neuron with about 1,300 synaptic connections before memory formation developed around 2,700 connections after long-term memory consolidation. Unlike computer memory's binary precision, biological memory exists in infinite gradations, governed by variable chemical and electrical signals. It's alive, contingent, and constantly changing. Memories are reconsolidated and updated each time we recall them. Our long-term memory has virtually boundless capacity, and the act of remembering strengthens our minds rather than constraining them. The web's constant stream of competing messages overloads working memory and makes it difficult for our frontal lobes to focus attention, preventing memory consolidation from starting. Through neuroplasticity, the more we use the web, the more our brains become trained for distraction rather than sustained attention. This creates a self-perpetuating loop. As our biological memory weakens, we rely more on the web's artificial memory, further diminishing our capacity for deep thought. When we outsource memory to external data banks, we threaten not just personal identity, but cultural distinctiveness. Playwright Richard Foreman laments how our complex, dense, and cathedral-like personalities are being replaced by a new kind of self evolving under the pressure of information overload. Without our inner repertory of dense cultural inheritance, we risk becoming pancake people, spread wide and thin across networks of instantly available information. Our brains readily incorporate tools into their sensory maps. When a carpenter holds a hammer, his brain perceives it as part of his hand. This extraordinary human capacity to meld with tools distinguishes our species and enables our technological prowess. However, this relationship works both ways. As technologies become extensions of ourselves, we become extensions of our technologies. The carpenter's hand becomes limited to what a hammer can do. Every tool imposes limitations, even as it creates possibilities. The more we use a tool, the more we mold ourselves to its form. This explains why those accustomed to word processors often lose facility with handwriting, a skill now disappearing from our culture. As media scholar John Culkin noted, we shape our tools, and thereafter, they shape us. The networked computer functions as an extraordinarily powerful neural amplifier with equally potent numbing effects. Norman Doidge explains that electronic media can effectively merge with our nervous systems because they operate similarly, creating a single larger system. Our brains are particularly susceptible to this merging because evolution has equipped us with specialized brain regions dedicated to understanding others' minds, a social instinct that inadvertently leads us to perceive minds in inanimate objects like computers. Research demonstrates how this cybernetic blurring limits us. Christoph van Nimwegen's studies showed that people using helpful software with extensive guidance ultimately performed worse at logic puzzles than those using bare-bones programs without assistance. The helpful software users developed less strategic thinking and relied more on aimless trial-and-error approaches. Similarly, James Evans's analysis of 34 million scholarly articles revealed that as academic journals moved online, researchers actually cited fewer articles and favored more recent publications, a narrowing of science rather than the expected broadening. Our minds function differently in natural versus urban environments. University of Michigan researchers demonstrated that people who spent time in nature showed significantly improved attention and cognitive control compared to those exposed to busy urban settings. Nature provides a respite from the constant stimulation that taxes our working memory, allowing our brains to relax and restore their attentiveness. The internet, however, offers no such sanctuary. Like a perpetual urban street, it bombards us with stimuli that, while invigorating, ultimately exhaust our cognitive resources. Without quiet contemplation, we risk losing not only deep thinking, but also our capacity for empathy and compassion. Antonio Damasio's research reveals that while our brains react instantly to physical pain, understanding psychological suffering requires slower neural processes. When we're constantly distracted, we may never fully experience the emotions necessary for moral decision-making about other situations. As technology increasingly replaces human judgment with algorithmic processing, we risk losing essential qualities that define our humanity. The example of Edexcel, Britain's largest educational testing firm, implementing AI-based automated essay grading, illustrates this danger. The company claims their system eliminates human elements such as tiredness and subjectivity, precisely the qualities that allow us to recognize unconventional brilliance. Technology's seductions of speed and efficiency are powerful, but we must consider what we stand to lose. As we rely on computers to mediate our understanding of the world, our own intelligence flattens into artificial intelligence, while our machines display more humanity than we do.